everybody. Everybody ready for us? We got a speaker, that's for sure. This is a special annual Thursday night men's group following the Barb speaker. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope that many alcoholic men and women in our room today desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. This was the second speaker, AA speaker, I ever saw in person. It was right here in this room. And the week before, I picked up my white chip. And I remember seeing the flyer, and it had Tinsley E. telling his story. And I'm going, I wonder if it's the same Tinsley that I was such a big fan of. And I was always amazed that he could perform so well and drink so much at the same time. When you see him take that green bottle of Heineken and take it the last sip and foam's coming down his finger and he's playing slide with it, I mean, it's a sight. I left that meeting wanting to get sober. And I've heard his story a bunch. And every time I hear it, I want to stay sober. So I hope the same effect happens for each and every one of you. Please give your attention to Tinsley.
Hey everybody, my name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 3rd, 1999. And I have a sponsor. My sponsor guys, I have a home group. It's the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting here, 8 p.m. every Monday night. We're a member of AA with one or more years of sobriety gets to tell his or her story. And what else? And I am 66 years old. I like to give my age when I tell my story so you won't be like me and spend the whole time thinking about, I wonder how old this guy is. But, so I just rip the Band-Aid off and tell you I'm 66 years old. And, you know, I'm not here because I hate drinking. I'm here because I love drinking. And I loved it too much, and it turned on me. And so promising in the beginning, but it turned on me. And it kind of reminds me of a story of a couple. They're regular drinkers, normal drinkers down in Sarasota, Florida, and they live there on the ocean, and they've got a dock off the back of their house there, and they can watch the sunset every evening over the Gulf of Mexico. I don't know if you've ever been down there on the Gulf and seen the sunset. It gets pretty amazing. And so this couple is out there at sunset, and they're drinking their wine out there on the dock and watching the sun set. Just as that sun, a big red ball of sun, hits the Gulf of Mexico, the silence is broken by the husband saying, I love you so much, I can't live without you. And the wife says, now, is that you talking or is that the wine? And the husband says, that's me. I'm talking to the wine. And that's the way it was with me and alcohol. I had a love affair with it. I let alcohol into my life as an invited guest. Then alcohol turned into a friend. Then alcohol turned into a constant companion. And then alcohol turned into a ruler. Then alcohol turned into a tyrant. And there's nothing I could do to keep it to make it go backwards to any of those other things once it became a tyrant in my life. And I was born here in Atlanta, 1957, at Piedmont Hospital. My parents were Emory students at the time. My mom was an undergrad at Emory. My dad was in law school at Emory. Was raised here in the house that my mother still lives in today, in Brookhaven. Was raised up actually in Florida. We moved down there for my dad to go into his dad's law practice in Broward County, and that was probably about 1960. I vaguely remember that. I vaguely remember my parents both getting out of Emory and moving down there. I was the only child at first, and had a sister and two brothers after that. I was the oldest one. I paved the path for all the others, and I did it well, I think. So if I had to characterize my upbringing, I would tell you that it is of the silver spoon variety. My dad's and grandfather's law practice was very successful, and I got everything I wanted growing up. I got a car when I was 16, promptly wrecked it, and I went to good summer camps, you know, up in the Carolinas, and I went to one of those kind of high schools. I went there for 6 years, junior high school and high school, a church school, a prep school it's called. It's supposed to prep you for college, which is supposed to prep you for life. And so I went to prep school, and it was one of those schools where I had to wear a coat and tie every day to school. Every day. A coat and a tie. And then since it was in South Florida, and the coat had the school patch on it. And then half the year, it was so hot down there, kind of like it is here today, so we wore short pants and a coat and a tie to school. A favorite attire of teenagers everywhere, right? Hardly. And I vowed I would never do that again, and so here I am today without a coat and tie on. Sorry, y'all. But and I was pretty churchy. I was nerdy. I was really good student, straight A student until, right? And then I was in the school singing group, the glee club, which is not a cool thing to be. And then when I was a senior, I was the president of the glee club, which made me the head nerd. And years later, when I got sober, I met another sober guy, and he said, "Well, if it makes you feel any better, I was president of the library club." And I thought, you got me beat there, finally. You know, where were you when I needed you? But anyway, that all changed when I guess I was 50, about 15 years old, and back then the drinking age was 18, and people, who knows what age people start drinking now, probably the same, probably hadn't changed, but went to a party, somebody's parents were out of town, down in South Florida, and it was outdoors, I remember, by the pool, and there was a couple hundred kids there, teenagers, and I was 15 years old, and somebody handed me a beer. I never had a beer before. Somebody handed me a beer, and I started drinking that beer, and I was amazed before I was halfway through. And I knew a new freedom. And things seemed so promising, and I found my people. Always looking for my people. That's where I thought my people were. And, you know, I drank that beer, and I went home and thought about how good it made me feel and how I felt like I was running with the big dogs, you know, and my clothes felt better. I felt funny, and there was so much laughter. And it was never that good again after that. It was never that good again. And so the next weekend we went out, got a whole bunch of beer, and we got really good and drunk. Because that's the way an alcoholic thinks, right? If one beer makes you feel that good, wouldn't 24 beers make you feel 24 times as good? And, you know, that's that moderation thing. I've got a real problem with moderation. I think we all do as alcoholics. The only thing an alcoholic does in moderation is the steps. But I know that that it all started that way. And then going all through high school and drinking was fun. I'll admit it. It was fun at first. We did wild, wild things drinking before the consequences set in. And I remember that I was at a party. I guess maybe at that point I was maybe a couple years into my drinking, and I shot a bottle rocket out of my ass at the party. And everybody just thought that was so great, and I went to school that Monday. But please keep in mind the reading Tim did earlier about it. We hope the stories aren't in bad taste, but I did this, and I was the man when I did that, right, at school. Everybody talked about it. Now, the problem with doing something like that is you got to top it. And I decided to top it by following my dream there. Around that same time, started playing in rock bands. And I bought into the whole thing that Jimi Hendrix played the hell out of a guitar because he was wasted. I really believe that. And they talk about that in this great book here, AA. Of course, they don't mention Jimi Hendrix, but they talk about it right off the bat in Bill's story. Bill Wilson is drinking, and he's arguing with his wife on page 2. It says, "Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived." And I really believe that. I really believe that if I wanted to be like my heroes, the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix and later the Allman Brothers, if I wanted to be like them, I had to get high. And I really believe that. And of course, you know, years later find out that this is where the inspiration is. It's in AA, and AA delivers everything that alcohol promised but failed to deliver. The camaraderie, the laughter. Boy, do we laugh at some weird stuff in meetings sometimes. And inspiration. My imagination is fired now because of AA. But anyway, I bought into that whole thing about drinking. You know, I was going to have to, and other substances. There's lots of other substances involved, but I just lump it all in with drinking. If something affects me from the neck up, I don't need any part in it, but we're here to talk about drinking. That's what I'm going to try to stick to. So I did all that stuff and, you know, playing in bands. And then I came up here when I graduated and went out to Emory Junior College out in Oxford, Georgia. And boy, was it wild in 1975 out there. And the dean of schools, this guy was like 120 years old or something. He didn't know what was going on. And they had a keg party every night. And I went to that keg party every single night. And if they didn't have a keg party on a certain night, I started one, you know. And it was there that I noticed my drinking was different than my friends. We'd all get really good and drunk, all my friends, because that's how I chose my friends, you know. They were not issued to me. You know, I chose them based on whether they drank or not. If they didn't drink, I would probably still be nice to them, but they weren't going to be my friends. So my friends and I got good and drunk every night, and then about midnight, then I'll pile into a car and go out to the Waffle House and get something to eat. And you know what? I never got in that car, not once. I could not figure out why people would be drinking and doing other stuff and didn't want to eat. Right? That'd bring you right down. And that's because I don't have a drinking problem. I have a stopping problem. And even more than a stopping problem, I have a staying stopped problem. And that's what y'all have helped me with. And so that's when I first noticed that my drinking was different. Now, I got out of college, came here to Big Emory and graduated somehow. I don't know how. I was playing in Underground Atlanta back in the day. And, of course, Underground Atlanta is a lot different than it is now. Back in the 70s, it was pretty damn wild and seedy, and I liked that about it. They probably should have kept it the same, but they didn't. Made it into a mall. But in the 70s, there was great bands on every corner. They'd have a band, Lynyrd Skynyrd, would be playing in one bar, and Hydra or Eric Quincy Tate would be playing in the other bar down the street, and I went and saw those bands, and then I started playing in those bars. And some or other graduated from college. Well, I didn't sign up for law school. My dad said, "Are you going to go to law school?" And I go, "No, I'm not going to go to law school." "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to be in a band." And he knew I was doing it. He had his suspicions, and he didn't like that idea one bit. He grew into it a little bit. My mom, I don't think she's ever grown into it, but my dad grew into it over the years. And I got out of college and hit the road with a blues band. Blues is my main music. That's the music I like the most. I had seen B.B. King as a teenager, and I just thought that was the greatest thing. Once I saw B.B. King, I could never think about, didn't think about the Beatles or the Rolling Stones after I saw the real thing. And Howlin' Wolf, I saw him, and Muddy Waters, I saw all the blues people. And got to know some of them, even got to play with some of them. But I did just like what they talk about in the big book in one of the stories where they say that a normal person, a non-alcoholic, chooses his behavior to match his goals. And an alcoholic chooses his goals to match his behavior. Well, what's my behavior? well, I'm a drunken fool, so I better get a job where that's allowed. And playing in a band was just that job, because there's only, y'all have heard me say this, I'm going to say it again because I think it's hilarious, but there's only two rules when it comes to drinking on stage in a band. Rule number one, no drinking during the gospel numbers. Rule number two, no gospel numbers. So basically it's wide open. We can do whatever we want to do, and it's really hard to get in trouble playing in bands, but I managed to do it. And when all of us started going all over the country, not having much success. In fact, in the beginning, we stayed seven people to one hotel room. But if you drink enough to be passed out, you don't really notice that you're sleeping on some floor somewhere in a seedy hotel. And so that was that's a young man's game, by the way, right there. So is show business in general, I think. But I'm still able to do it somehow. Thank you, God. But I started out as going all over the country, and that's when the consequences began. I was 21 years old and 22 years old, I think, and I drank myself into having a bleeding, perforated ulcer, and ended up in the hospital in Richmond. Had to leave the tour. My parents had to come. I was in there for a week, hooked up to machines, and the doctor, I remember, he had a chart, and my parents were there. They're terrified, you know, here I am hooked up to machines, and the doctor read this chart, and he said, young Mr. Ellis appears to be nothing more than a binge drinker. And I went, yes, I'm not an alcoholic. I wish he had said I was an alcoholic, but, you know, it's not somebody else's job to diagnose whether I'm an alcoholic or not. That's alcohol's job, and it does it really well. And I had gotten married to my college sweetheart, and she promptly got killed by her boyfriend after we were married, and I think it was right after we'd gotten divorced, and he killed himself. So there's a lot of stuff like that going on, but I had the feeling this is not going to happen to me. These bad things that are happening are not going to happen to me, even though people are dropping dead around me. And so lots of consequences happened. I'd gotten arrested, divorced, yelled at, you know, lost really good career opportunities. And so by the time I came to my first AA meeting in 1990, and I want you to notice that earlier I said my sobriety day is 1999. I came here first in 1990, so obviously something happened in between 1990 and 1999. You know, I was adrift on a sea of half measures, and because I kind of figured that half measures would avail me half, you know, but it doesn't work out that way. And so I came to my first meeting here, and when I came to my first AA meeting in 1990, here in this room, at 11 o'clock meeting, my cousin brought me, and I got this book. You notice this very book. You notice it's a soft cover book. I really didn't feel like I had hardcover recovery in me. I went for the cheapest option. This book has actually been all over the world with me. But anyway, when I came to that meeting, by that time in my life, everyone thought it was a good idea that I go to AA. Even the dope man thought it was a good idea that I go to AA. And when the dope man is the voice of reason, man, you got a problem. But I came in here and I wasn't serious about it. I just sort of checked this thing out. I got the book and I went home and read the book, went to a couple more meetings, and then I released myself on my own recognizance. And we all know how that works, right? You know, learning what works in recovery can be very valuable, but learning what doesn't work in recovery can be priceless. And it took every drink or joint or whatever I had to get me to the place where I could do this deal, to where I could do this deal. So in 1990, like I said, I half-assed it for 9 years, in and out of the rooms. I actually picked up some year chips, and I'll tell on myself I wasn't sober. I was still smoking pot, and I don't think that's sober at all. I didn't know any better, to tell you the truth. Or maybe I did and just ignored it, but picked up some dirty chips right here in this room. Not in a long time, but I did initially. And so in 1999, I was in really bad shape again, and I'd already been to the hospital a few more times. And once again, everybody thought it was a good idea that I give the meetings another go of it, and I knew what I needed to do, and I came back in and got a white chip, and I was at the Log Cabin Group, and if you want to know what the Log Cabin Group is, see me after the meeting. I'll tell you about that. And I was going to do it different this time. I was pretty beaten up, and I arrived in tears at that meeting. I arrived in tears. And, you know, before I arrived sarcastic and laughing and joking about this thing, and I think it helps to arrive in tears, have that gift of desperation, and that's the shape I was in. And I talked to a guy after that meeting, and I used to do this thing where I'd come to the meeting, you know, right at the last minute, and I'd leave either right before or right after the prayer. I didn't meet anybody. You know, I was wondering why everybody was so unfriendly, but it was me. I was the unfriendly one. And then over the years, I realized some guy said, well, you need to join the 2020 club. And I go, what's the 2020 club? He goes, well, those are the people that get there 20 minutes early and stay 20 minutes late. And there's some really damn good recovery in that 2020 club. And that's what I try to do now. And So I hung out after a meeting, and I talked to a guy after the meeting, and he talked to me like no person had ever talked to me before. Prior to talking to him, people would say stuff like, well, you know what your problem is, or you know what you got to do is. And he didn't talk to me that way at all. He talked to me the AA way, the 12-step way. He told me what it had been like for him, what happened, and what his life was like now. And he had a wild story. I mean, it was wild, wilder than mine. And I listened. He let me talk some. We had that back and forth kind of thing going on. And I remember he said, if you want what I have, do what I did. But what he did, you know, what my perception of what to do in sobriety is so skewed. It just all seems so complicated to me. I saw the 12 steps on one wall and the 12 traditions on one wall, and then there's a principle behind each of the steps and a principle behind each of the traditions, and damn, that seemed like 48 things right there. I'm a busy man. I don't have time for 48 things. And this guy told me that if I would do 5 things, I would stand a great chance of staying clean and sober. 5 things. I'm like, what are the 5 things? He said, 1, go to a ton of meetings. 2, get a competent sponsor of your own gender. 3, work all 12 steps in order. 4, learn how to pray. And 5, work with others. I said, that's it? And he goes, yeah, that's pretty much it. And I suggest you do that. You got to do it every day. I think he suggests that I do it every day, which was not part of my plan. I always thought I would come here for a while and maybe graduate or something like that. It doesn't seem to work that way. And first thing he recommended is I go to a ton of meetings. You know, the meetings changed the way I feel, and I was always looking to change the way I felt. That's one of the reasons alcohol in all its forms were so appealing to me. Meetings changed the way I feel. I can't tell you how many times I've gone to a meeting just really angry about something, usually work or family related, and I go to that meeting, and after the meeting, can't even remember what I was angry about. And that's what I wanted out of drinking, in a nutshell. I wanted it to cut that edge and, you know, make me feel better. You know, men and women go to meetings essentially for the effect produced by going to meetings, that ease and comfort. So the meetings are like the getting place, you know, and that's the most basic thing I can do. And also calling people on telephone, talking to them, and making plans to go to meetings. That's a great way to have a good day right there, because all of a sudden I'm thinking all day about a plan I have with another person to go to a meeting and hook up with them at that meeting. You know, I didn't really want to go to meetings. I remember saying, how many meetings do I have to go to? And y'all said, well, you only have to go to meetings until you want to go to meetings. It's just that change in perspective. I get to go to AA. I don't have to come here. I get to go. And now it's fun. I mean, one of the biggest problems I have is in life is which 8 o'clock meeting do I go to? You know, there's so many 8 o'clock meetings, and there's only one 8 o'clock. I mean, I wish they would have 8 o'clock meetings at other times during the day, but then it wouldn't be the 8 o'clock meeting, right? It would be whatever. But that's one of the biggest challenges I have, which is that's a quality problem if ever I heard of one right there. And so the meetings change the way I feel. And if I go to enough meetings, then I'm going to meet somebody, hear somebody share, and this guy might be a good sponsor. Because that's one thing I never did in those 9 years of Half Measures is get a sponsor. I mean, come on. I'm a smart guy. I mean, so good in other areas of my life. But that doesn't really cut it when it comes to alcoholism. We've got this peculiar mental twist. We can be successful in other areas of our life. But when it comes to drinking, it had me licked. So when it came to getting a sponsor, I still don't think I would have done it unless this man that I had told you about that told me about the five things. And he's in this meeting, by the way. I won't point him out. But he said, I'm going to be your temporary sponsor. And if he hadn't have done that, I think I'd be a dead man today because I'm too vain to ask somebody for help. A friend of mine shares that she thought the four hardest words to say were, I am an alcoholic. But I think the four hardest words to say are, will you help me? And I was too vain to do that. Will you help me? Yeah, four words. Okay, great. But anyway, so I he became my sponsor, and he wasn't my ride or my banker, or marriage counselor, psychiatrist, or anything. His job, his gig, is to take me through the 12 steps as outlined in the first 164 pages of this book. And getting a sponsor was the turning point of my recovery. And he was really nice at first. But then he started telling me some stuff that I didn't really like. I didn't really like the way this guy was talking to me. He told me that I was a liar and I was lazy and pointed out some stuff about me that I didn't really like it. But you know what? I sat there and I took it. And when he tells his story, he says it so well. He says that the turning point of his recovery was when he became willing to sit there and hear stuff about him that he would never have been able to sit there and listen to. So I sat there and I took it, and he took me through the 12 steps. Not too fast, not too slow, but we had a weekly meeting and we went through the steps. And the thing is I need a sponsor because I see things through a filter of my alcoholism. I see things the way alcoholism wants me to see things. In the big book, I think in The Family Afterwards or maybe Two Wives, it says, the alcoholic lives in a world that's distorted and exaggerated. And that's the way my alcoholism wants me to see things. So basically, a sponsor or another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous can help me see things the way they really are, not the way that my alcoholism wants me to see things. And I need help. I need help from y'all. I'm kind of like luggage at the airport. I should not be left unattended. You know, they tell you, they make that announcement, and that's a lot what I'm like. When I went to a recovery convention, the speaker said, because there's always the question, what makes a good sponsor? This person answered the question. He said, what makes it for a good sponsor is a willing sponsee. And I really believe that, a willing sponsee. And I was finally willing to do the suggestions. And he took me through the 12 steps. And in step one, I could really wrap my head around that because I was truly powerless over alcohol and drugs. And And powerlessness to me means that I drink, but I say I'm not going to drink. I drank even when I didn't want to drink. I had that obsession, that thought that overrides all other thoughts. Maybe during the day I wake up with a horrible hangover and I say, this shit has got to stop, never again, right? And then as the day goes on, I think, well, I'm just going to go out, you know, and it's not going to be like last night. Oh, no, no, no. And then I go out, you know, and sure enough, it was just like the night before every time. And the reason it was like the night before is the second part of powerlessness, which is the allergy. Remember how I said earlier with them, they'd all get in the car and go to the Waffle House, and I never got in the car. And that's that problem I have with stopping. You know, once I get started, I can't stop. That's the allergy. So I could wrap my head around the powerlessness. The unmanageability, you know, I really had a hard time with that. Even though my life truly was unmanageable, I had some career milestones. I still have it somewhere, but it's this album review I got in Rolling Stone magazine. It had happened, you know, prior to getting sober, but I still had that thing folded up that I could look at and see that my life was not unmanageable, but it certainly was, because alcoholism was a whole different beast than anything else in my life. And so when I was able to tie that powerlessness and the unmanageability all up together, I could realize that yes, I am one of y'all. I am an alcoholic, and I got to step two. And here comes the God talk, right? And I remember my sponsor said, "How are you with this God thing?" Anyway, and I said, "Well, I'm not too good with it." He said, "Why is that?" And I said, "Well, I don't believe in God, and I'm mad at God." And he pointed out that I was mad at something I didn't believe in, which is insanity right there. And he pointed out some really great stuff in step two. It says, "You can, if you'd like, even make AA itself your higher power." And I could realize how, you know, 60 people with a desire and a plan to stay sober is greater than one person's plan, my plan, and my desire. 60 is greater than one. 60 is a higher power of one. And that's how I was able to crack the door open and get on with this journey, was to be able to see it that way, the power of we. And I can define my higher power based on some shares y'all give in a meeting. You know, I hear somebody share, "Oh, that's a good higher power. I think I'll try that on." Recently, a guy at a meeting said his higher power was defined as the energy in the rooms. And there is definitely an energy that's undeniable here. And so being able to have my own concept of a higher power is a great thing. And then we get to step three, and I remember he had me take this book, and my sponsor had me fold down the page to the third step prayer. And he said, "Okay, after the meeting, we're going to get together in this small side room, and we're going to kneel down and pray the third step prayer together. And I want you to put your arm around my shoulder, and put my arm around your shoulder, and we're going to say this third step prayer together." And I remember thinking, "Oh, hell no." But you know what? I could recall with sufficient force the pain and suffering of my last debauch. And I knew that it was either going to be the floor or the door. And I had hit the door a number of so many times before with bad consequences. So I knelt down on that floor with him and said that prayer. And I think what that represented, of course, in the old days of AA, they would call that making your surrender. But I think what it represented to me is me doing something that not only I didn't want to do, but me doing something that I did not understand why I was doing it. And that's a good description of what goes on here in AA, is me doing some stuff that I don't understand why I'm doing it, taking that leap of faith. And I did that third step prayer and turned my will and my life, my thinking and my actions over to a higher power, just enough to where I was able to get out of the way, because I spent my whole life in the way, get out of the way enough to be able to take these action steps. And you know, steps 1, 2, 3 got me sober. Steps 10, 11, 12, keep me sober. Steps 4 through 9 deal with the quality of my sobriety and the quality of my happiness, too. And in step 4, I take that action. I make that list of all the things that have kept me thirsty for so long. My fears, my resentments, the harms, my sex conduct, all of these things that have been eating at me that have kept me thirsty for so long. Now, I didn't drink because of the stuff I put on my fourth step. I drink because I'm an alcoholic. But these things that I put on my fourth step are the things that led me back towards a drink when I wasn't working this program, when I wasn't taking these suggestions. The things that have made me thirsty, the things that lead me towards the drink. And I'm either moving towards a drink or away from a drink. No such thing as standing still in recovery. That's resting upon my laurels, I think is the way they describe it in the book. Now, you know, I really did not want to do my fourth step. I mean, who does, frankly, right? And he made it pretty easy. He gave me some worksheets. And, you know, my current sponsor, you know, when I got with him, he said he wanted me to do a fourth step. And I said, should I use the worksheets? And he says, did the big book tell you to use the worksheets? So I thought he was going to start me on step 10 or something, but no, he busted me all the way back to step 1. But anyway, the worksheets were really helpful to me because, frankly, I don't know if I would have done it if I didn't have those. They kept me organized, and there was so much noise in between my ears at the time. And I remember my sponsor at the time told me to start my fourth step, and the next week to bring and show it to him, the work I had done. And of course, the next week I came and didn't have anything done, didn't have anything written down. And I said, I've been really busy. I can't find a good time to start. And I remember he said, well, a good time to start your fourth step is when you're ready to be clean and sober. And so that made me mad. So I wrote some stuff down and brought back and showed him the next day and made these lists of all these things that have kept me thirsty. And we did the fifth step, and it was over at his house. And, you know, I was heading over there and wondering why I was driving like 40 miles an hour on I-85. And that's about how eager I was to start. But I went over there, and he told me some stuff that he had done, and that helped me have the courage to tell him some stuff I'd done. We did this back and forth thing, and I got through that fifth step. And all of a sudden, when I left, I tell you, I was so relieved. And you know, relief is what I was looking for in drinking. I said it earlier, and I'll say it again: this program delivers everything that alcohol promised but failed to deliver. You know, that ease and comfort. And in step 6 and 7 in the big book, was so important, and one of the reasons I think the 12 and 12 was written was because they didn't feel like they explained steps 6 and 7 well enough. And you know, there's only a few paragraphs in the big book, but that's the meat and potatoes of this whole program. Because what good does it do for me to make a list of all the stuff that has kept me thirsty and tell another person about these things? And what good does it do those things if I'm not willing to do something about it? And I never really understood steps 6 and 7, where I, you know, ask God, and first I say that God's going to help me relieve me of these defects of character, these shortcomings. And then, you know, then I have a prayer that's going to help me do that. But I never really understood what that was until a guy in the room said, well, you know, when you're guitar goes out of tune, you don't take the clippers and cut all the strings off your guitar. You reach up there and you tune the guitar, you tune the instrument. And I think that's what goes on in steps 6 and 7, is I tune the instrument. You know, I tune my fears. You know, a little bit of fear is a good thing. You know, without a little bit of fear, I'm going to swim in shark-infested waters or something like that. But a whole bunch of fear, which is the way I'm wired to do, you know, do a lot of it, a whole bunch of fear is not going to make me immortal. And a whole bunch of resentment is not going to make me the king of the world. And so fine-tuning these instincts that have run amok in me, and That was the best description I had, that guitar tuning thing. And then steps 8 and 9, you know, making amends. I was the type of drinker that would have to get drunk before I went out to get drunk, because there was going to be some people there, and they're sideways with me, and I can't face them. Sometimes I can't even remember why I'm sideways with them, but they're going to be there. I can't face them stone cold sober, so I'm going to have to get drunk. It makes me really thirsty. Few things have made me thirstier than unmade amends. And I think, you know, amends, I was taught not to say I'm sorry. They had heard that enough. They had heard that enough. And I was taught to say I was wrong. Not I'm sorry, but I was wrong. How can I make this right? And, you know, when they amend the U.S. Constitution and government, they don't apologize to it. They fix it. They change it. And that's what my loved ones want to see in me is a change. First of all, they were so happy that I wasn't drinking or drugging anymore. And seeing that change is a great form of amends. Not I'm sorry. You know, a remorseful mumbling of I'm sorry doesn't cut it is what I think the literature says. And I was taught other amends to make, you know, amends, to talk about financial amends, and y'all taught me to lead with the green, right? If I'm going to make a financial amends, to have a little bit of cash, you know, when I make that amends, that's good stuff right there. And to make direct amends, you know, these people, that I offended, I probably need to face them. No, I did not offend him by letter. You know, I can't write him a letter. I need to face them and make direct amends. So these amends are so important. I was also taught not to go on and on like I tend to do, because the more I talk, the more the story gets legs and starts walking around on its own, you know. And I may say something in amends like, well, while I was not entirely wrong, you know, like, whoa, that's not an amends. That's more argument right there. So y'all taught me how to make it in the clear-cut direction, definitely in the big book. And then in our fellowship, we've got some different ways of doing it. Now, step 10, what an amazing step that is, you know, to use these tools that I've gotten in steps 4 through 9. And continue to look for selfishness, self-seeking, and inconsiderate. Continue to look for those things. And it becomes a practice. And I love what it says in step 10 where it says, we're not fighting alcohol. That's good, because every time I fought alcohol, it won. We're not shielding ourselves from temptation. Well, that's good, because I can avoid anything but temptation. We're not swearing off. Well, that's good. Every time I swore off alcohol, I swear right back on it. And those were all my thoughts of how to stay sober. So what is this that we're doing in here? I think what we do, what I have done in AA, is building the type of life that I no longer want to escape from in the steps and in the network and having a sponsor, building the type of life that I no longer want to escape from, where I'm not thinking about drinking. It just doesn't come to my mind. Every once in a while it does. Remember, I was up in North Dakota one time and it was really cold. It was the opposite of today and here in Georgia. But I thought, well, maybe, you know, maybe if I had a coffee and Kahlua, maybe the caffeine would cancel out the Kahlua or something like that. And I thought, no, can't do that. I'm an alcoholic and I can't have that. So every once in a while, the insane thought will come. But in general, I'm not thinking about it. And that's the 10th step promises. Those are the extravagant promises, by the way, I think. Really amazing. And then in step 11, you know, having a prayer life, which is one of the fourth thing that my sponsor at the time had recommended, learning to pray. Learn to pray. That means I probably don't know how to do it. The kind of prayers I used to say were, God, get me out of this mess. I'll never act up again. And then when I wouldn't get out of the mess, then I could say there is no God. Or if I did get out of the mess, then I would renege on my promise not to act up again. Either way, I was clearly not praying right. I love the fact in AA that we can have prayers that suit us. It talks about that. They talk about prayers that might be in the other big book, you know, or prayers that we share amongst ourselves. And a prayer that I have learned that has really helped me so many times was a friend of mine that I used to be in a band with a long time ago. Somebody called and said, he's dying of cancer. And I go, oh gosh, you know, we weren't really that close, but we weren't estranged either. It was just always uncomfortable because the deal had gone kind of bad between us. And so my friend said, he's over in Emory Midtown, Crawford Long Hospital. And I knew I needed to go see him. Now, the old me would have just blown it off and gotten drunk, you know, been so ashamed and gotten drunk. Or drank a bunch or done some kind of a pill or something and gone in there and blubbered all over the man and made things worse. And so I shared about it at a meeting, and someone at the meeting says, here's what you should do. He said, when you get to that hospital door, you say a prayer. You say, okay, God, you go first. Okay, God, you go first, that prayer. And so I got to Bob's hospital door, and I said, okay, God, you go first. And I followed my higher power, my God, into that hospital room, and Bob and I had the best visit. We didn't once mention what he was going through, except to, you know, he said, I get to go home tomorrow. That meant he was going home into hospice. He died a few days later, and we reminisced about old times, and then I left. I left his room, and Bob said, I'll see you again. I'll see you again. I said, yeah, I'll see you again, Bob, and I really do believe I will see him again. And we had the best visit. And the reason it was the best visit is because of that prayer, God, you go first. God doing for me what I could not do for myself. God doing for me what alcohol never would do for me. So I love the prayers that we can share amongst each other. And then step 12, the best description of step 12 is in Bill's story on page 15. He's Bill Wilson is newly sober. There's no meetings. There's no AA. There's no steps. There's no nothing. He's just winging it, and he's newly sober. He's also out of work. He had burned a lot of bridges in his business. And it's the Great Depression, you know. Bill Wilson writes, my wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate, for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time, and I was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I've gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough going. So here he is. He can't find any work. I think this might be a time where he and his wife were living with her mother. He was sober, but he was thirsty. He was thirsty. He was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. And those waves will come on us, sober or not. Finding a way to deal with those waves of self-pity and resentment is the name of the game here in AA. And when all other measures failed, to work with another alcoholic would save the day. He went in there to his old detox ward and talked to people, sobered up, and helped them. All of a sudden, his problems vanished. Not only did his problem and his thirst vanish, but he would be amazingly lifted up. That's what I wanted out of alcohol. I wanted it to amazingly lift me up. And it did in the beginning, but it let me down every time after that. And then most importantly, it says, it is a design for living that works in rough going. It is a design for living that works in rough going. The going's going to get rough. We might get fired, you know, be sober, might get fired. Definitely going to have loved ones die. A couple years ago, I was in my basement working on my music, and
My wife came downstairs, came around the corner. And I could tell something was horribly wrong, tears going down her face. She said, "The police are here. Our son is dead." And Trey had gone to a lot of meetings with me in this room. He was such a good boy, and a lot of y'all knew him and loved him, and he just couldn't beat the game, and it killed him. And so it was horribly sad. And that night, I went to a meeting and shared about what had happened, and I said, "But I'm not going to drink, because thanks to this program and thanks to this fellowship, not once did I think about taking a drink." And that's why this program works in Roughville. And if I do this deal, I'm going to be able to get through anything without a drink in my hand. So to me, the miracle of recovery isn't that I don't drink. The miracle of recovery is that I don't want to drink. So thank you for my sobriety.
Thank you, Tinsley. Did I oversell it?
No.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for coming.
Amen.